Podcasts for PRI's The World are made possible in part by the generous support of our donors. Visit PRI.org/give and ensure that outstanding global programming continues. After all, it's your world. Jump in. No Chinese food at Jewish Christmas in Jerusalem. Today, December 25th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. There's a Catholic church in Jerusalem where there are more Jews than Christians at midnight mass. The priest there says they come to hear songs like Silent Night in German.
Personally, I think Silent Night is the most terrible kitsch, really, and the most sentimental and overplayed melody. But it's Christmas, and half of Christmas is kitsch to begin with, the popular culture. So I think people come because they enjoy the sentimentality of the German traditional Christmas, you know.
Also, a French pastry chef who makes a special type of bread gets philosophical about baking molds.
Some molds have survived not only 300 years of baking, but also 300 years of war.
And Santa Claus hits the mall in Turkey.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations and communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Before anything else, this day is a birth commemoration, and today thousands of Christians flock to Bethlehem to celebrate the birth of Jesus. A few miles away, in Jerusalem, crowds of people had attended a midnight mass. It was at a church marking the spot where Jesus' mother Mary was said to have lived and died. The large turnout was not a total surprise, but there's something peculiar about this midnight mass in Jerusalem. Almost all of the people who attend are Jews. Daniel Estrin has a story.
Some might joke that there are more Jews in Jerusalem who attend midnight mass on Christmas Eve than synagogue on the Jewish holidays, but there's some truth to it. Throngs of Israeli Jews clamor at the gate of the Dormition Abbey about an hour and a half early to get a good seat at midnight mass. Seats are snatched up the moment the doors open. Israelis sit cross-legged on every available inch of the mosaic floor. They are here not as believers, but as voyeurs.
It's a nice show, you know. I like it. It's a good choreography, you know. I can appreciate a good show, man.
We're here to share the happiness of the different holidays and hours. You know, it's also just fun.
Hundreds of Israelis are here. Many are university students with dreads and piercings and funky gold leggings. Liel Magen works at an intercultural center just up the alleyway from the church. He says he goes to all kinds of religious celebrations in Jerusalem.
I think it's important to be tolerant and interested in other religions, especially those that live among us as neighbors. I don't think that we need to be separate. The beauty of the city is that we can celebrate all year long.
Towards the front, Sebastian Kückler is a bit agitated. He and his companion are Catholic tourists from Cologne in Germany.
We hope it gets some, not as loud as now. For Christ, it's quite burdened. For us, it's one of the most important days in the year.
Israelis aren't known to be the most demure, quiet people, even in synagogue. But amazingly, it does quiet down, and the organ belts out its majestic chords. Then a monk delivers greetings in Hebrew. Tonight, he says, we celebrate the birth of a Jew who lived in this land about 2,000 years ago. We are honored tonight to host the people of Yeshua, the Hebrew name for Jesus. We've waited for you all year long, he says. The Jewish crowd presents a delicate challenge. Father Gregory, the abbot, says he has a strong awareness of the fact that these are the people of Israel, what he calls the original people of God. But he's careful not to proselytize. Israeli law restricts missionary activity here, and the Catholic Church also discourages it. Centuries of forced conversion by Christians in the past have made Jews and Catholics sensitive to this. And Father Gregory and his monks regularly experience harassment by fundamentalist Jews who spit at them. So what does a clergyman preach to a church full of Jews on Christmas Eve?
I always try to preach quite carefully. In other words, I talk about the Jewish roots of Jesus. I do stress as Christians, naturally, that we believe that Jesus is the Son of God and the Messiah. And I acknowledge that most of the people in the church don't, in fact, believe that. But I think it's not a time for theological discussions. It's a time for celebrating the birth of Christ. And the area where we can all agree is on Jesus' summary of the Jewish law: love God and love your neighbor as yourself.
I think most people are willing to accept that whoever he was, Jesus taught some really remarkable things.
Most of the people I spoke to here told me they don't attend synagogue regularly. But Father Gregory says when he looks out at the crowd, he can tell they're touched.
And they look fascinated and calmed, actually, by the whole movement of the liturgy. When its liturgy is done well, it is a very beautiful and dignified thing. And I think it's a point of contact where they understand that something sacred or something special is going on.
It is a special atmosphere. The pomp, the glistening mosaic dome, the harmonies of the choir. But Father Gregory admits there's one other thing about his midnight mass that makes it an Israeli crowd pleaser.
We sing Silent Night in German, and everybody loves Silent Night. I personally think Silent Night is the most terrible kitsch, really, and the most sentimental and overplayed melody. But it's Christmas, and half of Christmas is kitsch to begin with, the popular culture. So I think people come because they enjoy the sentimentality of the German traditional Christmas, you know.
And hey, there's food too. After Mass, the monks invite the Israelis for coffee and biscuits. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Even if Christmas isn't the holiday you grew up with, it can be a time for family to get together anyway, simply because it's often a day off. That's the case for many refugees here in the U.S., Shuka Kalantari reports on how some refugee families in Oakland, California, add their own twist to Christmas.
When Patience Wilson and her family came to Oakland as Liberian refugees 8 years ago, she had a bit of culture shock when she saw how Christmas is celebrated in the U.S.
We were kind of surprised that they put a tree in their house for Christmas, and they just put stuff on it.
Wilson remembers how things were in Peacetown, the Liberian refugee camp she once lived in the Ivory Coast. She says Christmas there was one big party for the whole community, not just family.
You know how people go out for Halloween and get candy? For Christmas, we go out and knock on people's door and say, Happy New Year or something like that, you get money.
It's what the kids did. Then, the neighborhood would gather to make music. That's Wilson's grandfather, Robert. He brought her and her other relatives over to Oakland when Wilson was 10 years old. She's now a senior in high school. Her grandparents left Liberia because of civil war and their ties to clashing ethnic groups. Now the family joins hundreds of other Liberian refugees who have resettled in California. In the refugee camp, they lived off food rations, but would trade with locals for luxuries like yams and plantains. Wilson remembers that during the holidays back then, they'd go all out, eating fried rice called jatov rice and tons of plantains. She says she'll be making one of those plantain dishes for Christmas dinner here and shows me how she does it.
There's some where it's mashed up and it's really spicy. Those were my favorite, but I don't know how to make it. So I just make these ones where you just fry them.
She chops up the plantains and cooks them in hot oil until they brown. Then her grandfather sees if they're up to par.
She did great. She made it sweet.
Lauren Markham says it's food that connects refugees to home. She works with refugees from around the world through a group called Refugee Transitions. Markham says food is a way to strengthen self-esteem, especially among newly arrived refugee women.
Being in a place where you're sort of always a recipient of services, to be able to offer something to someone and be able to offer a gift from your own heart and that you made is a really powerful thing.
Markham often asks refugees for recipes, and they're thrilled to share. It's a chance for them to be the teacher in a foreign land. And that's what inspired Markham to make a refugee cookbook called Between Meals. It'll be out in February. Markham says refugees can struggle to retain their own cultures while integrating U.S. culture, like the American Christmas. 21-year-old Chu Mai and her family have fully embraced Christmas. They're Karen refugees, an ethnic minority in Burma. She says her family was Buddhist, but they would celebrate each year with their Christian neighbors in her refugee camp in Thailand.
In Thailand, if you put the candle in front of your house, and people come sing in your house, and then you can pay like you can give like candy, a little bit gift.
After 9 years in the refugee camp, Chumai's family relocated to a growing Burmese neighborhood in Oakland. A large number of Karen in Oakland are Christian, so Chumai's family soon adopted that religion as their own. Chumai's mother, Natu, goes into the kitchen and boils water to prepare one of her holiday dishes, a traditional Karen soup with lemongrass, lime, and chicken called dak la chi. Chumai's family still cooks Karen food on Christmas. Even though they've converted to Christianity, they still hold on to their Burmese background through food. Chumai says she even goes Christmas caroling, but they sing in their own language. Chumai's mom sings us one of those Karen carols. Chumai's family bought their first Christmas tree this year and put up a neon sign that says Merry Christmas. Patience Wilson, the Liberian refugee, is also buying her first tree with money saved from an after-school job. Both of the girls' families get December 25th off, and that is reason enough to celebrate. For The World, I'm Shuka Kalantari, Oakland.
If you think of the world as a little village, the police scanner today would read something like, all is partly calm, but not necessarily bright. In some places, not bright and not calm at all. You know, we ought to take the day off from reporting the bad, but the news goes on. So a quick roundup now of today's Christmas headlines with a holiday sensibility. In Iraq, violence has been all too common this past year. Sunni and Shia Muslims have been going after each other. But today, the violence was targeted at Christians. Bombers hit churches in Baghdad, one right in the middle of its Christmas mass. Dozens of people were killed in the two attacks.
Sana le piaghe dell'amato Iraq.
The violence in Iraq was one of the topics Pope Francis dealt with today in his first ever Christmas address from the Vatican. He also spoke of the growing conflict in South Sudan that threatens to slide into civil war. And the Pope talked about the fighting in South Sudan's neighbor, the Central African Republic.
Dona pace, bambino, alla Repubblica Centroafricana.
The Pope also remembered all those people who fled conflicts in Africa this year, like the ones in CAR and South Sudan and so many other countries, only to end up in places like Lampedusa. Each day, migrants arrive on the tiny Italian island, many paying the biggest price of all for their flight, their lives. In the Philippines today, where Typhoon Haiyan touched down early last month, life remains hard. But Christmas also was a reminder for Father Madeo Alvero of the hope and hard work that's kept his community focused since the storm.
We may be homeless, you know, and we may be roofless, but we are not hopeless. We are hopeful na babangon po ang Tacloban, babangon po ang Leyte sa pagtutulungan po ng every one of us.
The priest said those Filipino cities will rise again, so hope in the Philippines. But in Syria, hope is in very short supply today. This is the third Christmas since the war there started. 1 in 10 Syrians have fled their country. Christmas this year happens to fall during an air offensive launched by Bashar al-Assad, targeting opponents in Aleppo. 400 people have reportedly been killed, including more than 100 children. The Pope today called for the free flow of aid to the people of Syria. But perhaps this is the most relevant statement on the situation there. It's a drawing, a very sarcastic drawing, from a Syrian satirist from Aleppo. His name is Sedki al-Imam. I tweeted the image earlier today. Imam's image shows Santa Claus in his sleigh being pulled by 3 fighter jets dropping bombs against a beautiful full moon and a blue starry sky. Taj Taj, a Christmas song there in Arabic from the great Lebanese artist Fairuz. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. and by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Jackie Pfeiffer, he's one of the world's great pastry chefs. You might have seen him in a documentary a few years back called Kings of Pastry. Pfeiffer's the co-owner of the French Pastry School in Chicago. He teaches young chefs everything from tarte aux framboises, or raspberry tart, to chocolate eclairs. But if you ask him for something close to his heart, he'll tell you about a special bread from his homeland. In the latest installment of our ongoing look at global chefs and tastemakers, Pfeiffer tells us about Kugelhopf.
I grew up in Alsace in France, on the east side of France, in a small bakery run by my father and my mom. The name of the village is Marlenheim. There's about 3,000 people living in the village, and that village had three bakeries, which is a lot. But they were all busy. People in France love to come in the morning, buy bread, and just enough bread for the day, and then that's it. The Kugelhopf is the most famous bread in Alsace. Every family has one, especially during celebrations or just on weekends. It's kind of like a brioche, but with not so much butter. Kind of like a poor's man brioche, you could say. And then the flavor of the kirsch in the raisins and then the almonds on top just adds some exciting features. A baker has to get organized before he starts a project. There's no panicking, there's no freaking out, there's no winging in pastry. It started because Alsace is a region where they have clay that works really well for mold making, and they've been making molds since the Middle Ages. The Kugelhopf mold is kind of like a bun-shaped mold that has a hole in the center, but such molds are also made in completely different shapes. Fish, lobsters, fleur-de-lis, all of these shapes have a symbolic meaning. For instance, a lobster is a synonym of fertility because families at the time wanted a lot of children. Don't ask me why. And if you ever seen fish eggs or lobster eggs, they have thousands of eggs, yeah? So families would make a cake before the end of the year in the shape of a lobster, hoping that the next year they would have a child. The fleur-de-lis molds obviously come from before 1789, while we still had kings before they cut their heads off. And there is a Christmas mold, it's shaped in a star. People would make it, and then it would be eaten with the entire family, always for good luck, always hoping for a better next year. Noël, Noël, si loin de ma maison. So I'm going to cut through the Kugelhopf. It's still a little warmish. The flavor that we are looking for in a mold like this, in an antique mold like this, is the flavor of baked butter, baked over many generations. To me, it's fascinating that some molds have survived not only 300 years of baking, but also 300 years of war. I mean, just take World War I and World War II. When Germany invaded Alsace, right away, we were always the first one in line, and a lot of destruction, a lot of pillage. But then there was many wars before that. So imagine having a mold that is 300 years old and that survived all this. And here I am baking with that mold. It's just, to me, it's just fascinating.
That's pastry chef Jackie Pfeiffer, originally from Alsace, France. He told his story to The World's Alex Gallifant. Pfeiffer's made thousands upon thousands of Kugelhopfs in his time. If you want to make your own, we've got the recipe from Pfeiffer's new book, The Art of French Pastry. It's online at PRI.org. Okay, Christmas Eve, last night, Santa Claus takes off from the North Pole with his flying reindeer and sleigh. So the story goes. But, you know, St. Nicholas is actually from someplace much warmer. Dalia Mortada has that story.
It's that time of year again. The mall is festooned with lights, wreaths, and ornaments. What looks like a giant evergreen tree towers over the atrium. But I'm not back home in Virginia. I'm in Istanbul, in Turkey, a country officially 99.8% Muslim. Not a place where most people actually celebrate Christmas.
Yılbaşı şey olarak nasıl söyleyeyim, sistemleri olarak çok hoşuma gidiyor.
The decorations are gorgeous, Esma says. I love that they do this for New Year's and we exchange gifts on New Year's. I think that's very nice. If you notice, this is all for New Year's. The trees with ornaments, the reindeer bedecked with lights, the very Christmas-like tchotchkes in the shops. And Santa.
To be honest with you, as I was growing up, I was not aware of the Christmas concept at all.
But Zeynep Akyalp's aware of it now. She's an Istanbul native with a luscious fake tree in her living room, decorated with colorful ornaments, white lights, and tinsel.
What's happening in the malls is only for economy, trying to get the economy going. They're just combining this season with sales this year, if you realize it. It's huge sales everywhere, and it wasn't like this before.
But it's not as if Santa Claus is entirely unknown in Turkey. He's called Noel Baba, kind of like Father Christmas. And Saint Nick was a real guy, a Greek saint from Lycia in southern Turkey. But not everyone's happy about the rising popularity of Santa. Just this week, an Istanbul municipality announced they're banning Santa from their neighborhood. And there's a call for Muslim youth to protest against Christmas and Santa. For some Turkish kids, though, that particular debate is irrelevant. Or so say Zeynep and her daughter Selin, who's 6 years old.
They somehow know the real Santa is the, like, parents with wallets.
Do you know that?
Yes, because...
Spoiler alert.
Santa isn't real.
But he is good for business. For the world, I'm Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
Okay, forget what you just heard, and let's get back to the fiction and all the letters to said fictitious character. With email and text messages, you may think that kids have just given up on reaching the big man with pen and paper, but you'd be wrong, according to something called the Universal Postal Union, or UPU. The UPU is a specialized United Nations agency based in Switzerland that serves as a forum for postal services worldwide. According to a recent survey by the UPU, some 8 million letters to Santa will be mailed this year. Here's a question, though. What country reported fielding the most letters to Santa in 2012? The United States? Nope. One of the Nordic countries? It's actually France, where some 1.7 million letters were addressed to Père Noël, according to last year's figures. Canada wasn't far behind with 1.3 million. Our friends north of the border even created a Santa-specific postal code, H-O-H-O-H-O. So, what's the verdict? Were you nice last year? Did Santa leave you a tablet in your stocking? If yes, you're going to want to put some of the world's great stories on that device. And one of the best ways to do that is with an app called Flipboard. It turns your radio into a magazine whose pages you can flip through and at the same time hear all the voices you know from our show. It's really cool, and it runs on an iPad, iPhone, or Android device. You can find that at flipboard.com/the world. And speaking of things to read, later in the program, my colleagues and I highlight some of our favorite books from the past year. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, in Rome, a boy talks about auditioning for the choir in the Vatican. In the audience, the Pope.
It's the first time I sing in Christmas with the Pope, and it's big, big emotion.
No pressure there. That's ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations and communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Healthcare Center. You can learn more at medtronicphilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. As 2013 winds down, we want to spend some time looking back at a special project we've had underway this year. The world's Anders Kelto has essentially embedded himself at a high school in South Africa. It's a fascinating place, a high-achieving public school in a poor part of Cape Town called Khayelitsha. Since South Africa is in the southern hemisphere, the school year pretty much follows the calendar year, which means our project is about to come to an end. We're going to bring you a few stories from our series now. Let's start by revisiting how Anders launched the series at the beginning of the year.
500 students stand in matching blue sweaters, white collared shirts, and blue ties. They're here for the first day of school. They chat and hug and swap stories about their summer vacations. Then, they form orderly lines and file into a school auditorium. And once everyone's seated, a teacher stands and begins singing. Soon, the whole school joins in. It's an old South African hymn that inspired the national anthem. This school is a magnet high school that attracts many of Khayelitsha's top students. It's called the Center of Science and Technology, or COSAT for short. It's been incredibly successful. Most years, every single senior graduates, and 70% go on to college, despite the fact that most come from poor, uneducated families. The school's principal, Fadila Cooper, steps on stage to officially open the 2013 school year.
Good morning, students.
Good
morning. Wow, the hall is too small for all of us now. Yes.
Mrs. Cooper begins the opening assembly by paying tribute to last year's graduates and reminding everyone of the school's record of success.
Now, we have a history of 100% pass rate. Now, in 2012, we did not make that.
But, she quickly adds, the one senior who did not pass will be retaking final exams in March.
And that person will then restore our 100% pass rate again.
Then it's time for the main event, a ceremony to honor the school's top academic achievers. Students with the best grades are called on stage to receive a handshake and a box of chocolate. Before each student is named, the tension builds.
And in position number one, Bridget Ngidi.
The message of the opening ceremony is clear. Students here are expected to do well, no matter what stands in their way. Or, in the words of the school motto, no excuses, just success. But the drive to succeed is about more than chocolate and recognition. Tandi is a 12th grader with a student government pin on her sweater and an endearing gap between her front teeth. She tells me that most of the kids here live in shacks that are falling apart, with no running water and no toilets.
Like, for example, I live in a place called Lloyd, and the conditions there are really bad. You wouldn't believe it if you could see it.
She says she wants to do well in school so she can get a good job.
I can get my family out of those shacks and buy them a proper house.
Being at a school like this means she'll have that opportunity, but it also means pressure. Tandi says her mother constantly mentions how she's counting on her to build them a better life. Tandi says that, like many students, she's terrified of failure.
I mean, your family's future depends on you, and when you make a mistake, all comes crumbling down. Think of how many futures are you ruining.
That pressure can have tragic consequences. Last year, a 10th grade boy failed his final exams and was told he had to repeat sophomore year. The school's principal, Fadila Cooper, says she tried to comfort him.
I explained to him that it's just a year that you're going to take longer to reach your goal.
He nodded and seemed to accept what she said. But then he left the school and sent text messages to his brother and friends.
And he told them that he had failed and he doesn't feel as if it is worth living.
The boy committed suicide. As the new school year begins, his death looms over the school.
I want you guys to go to page 37.
And there's a fear that the pressure on students and teachers will be even more intense this year. That's because the school is growing rapidly. The South African government, having seen the school's success, has forced it to expand from 190 students to 500 in just 3 years. Again, the school's principal, Fadila Cooper.
We are getting more and more of the learners who have not been prepared adequately. You know, they don't have the basics in maths and science.
And some teachers worry these students will fail. But what if COSAT can maintain its near 100% graduation rate on a much larger scale? What if it can turn even poorly prepared students into scientists? If it can, a lot of people will be asking how, and whether this model can be replicated in other poor communities, in Africa and elsewhere. For The World, I'm Anders Kelto in Cape Town.
We originally broadcast that story in March. Since then, Anders has followed several students at COSAT to see how they fared. One of our favorite stories is about Tandi. You heard her in that opening story. In September, Anders caught up with her as she prepared for a night of glamour, the senior prom.
I met Tandi at her home. She wanted to show me her prom dress. She pulled it out of a closet and ran her hands over the fabric.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
It was long and silver with a purplish hue. It glittered. I couldn't help but notice the contrast between Tandi's dress and her home, a rusty three-room shack. The windows had no glass, just bedsheets stretched across, and the walls were lined with rotting cardboard. Tandi's mom makes just $200 a month and raises three kids. So back in January, at the beginning of the South African school year, it wasn't clear if Tandi would be able to afford the $30 ticket for prom or the cost of a dress, shoes, and jewelry.
So I thought, okay, let me plan ahead of time.
Tandi came up with an idea. She started selling candy at school, which actually violated school policy.
So I guess I kind of took a risk, but a really positive risk if you think about it.
She made just 10 cents per piece of chocolate contraband. But over several months, that added up to $30. Meanwhile, her mother and her aunt scraped together another $60. And a teacher at school helped out and bought Tandi a pair of shoes. As Tandi told me the story, I couldn't help but wonder, why did prom matter so much? I asked Tandi. She said, partly, she just wanted to feel glamorous for a night.
I've never worn heels. I've never worn a formal dress with makeup. I've never, done makeup, actually.
And she said the prom was a chance to celebrate a big accomplishment. In a few months, she will be the first in her family to finish high school. Prom day arrived. I went back to Tandi's house. Rain was dripping through the tin roof. Tandi's brother played music on an old stereo while Tandi put on her gown and 5-inch heels. Her mom stepped back to look at her.
Hello, baby. You look awesome.
Thanks.
Tandi grabbed an umbrella and changed into sneakers. She stepped outside, onto the muddy roads that surround her shack. She got into a friend's car and headed to school. Outside the school's entrance, a huge group had gathered. There were students from several high schools and members of the community. As the seniors arrived, one by one, the crowd screamed wildly. It felt like a celebrity fashion show. Tandi's car pulled up. She opened the car door and stepped onto the sidewalk, her red carpet for the night.
Wow. Yes, wow.
Her classmates were clearly impressed, but other seniors weren't so fortunate. A girl in a blue dress walked by, and the crowd went silent. I asked a group of 11th grade girls why.
That dress looks cheap. Compared to the ones that we've seen before, it's just not doing it.
Clearly, looking good and wealthy was important, even in this very poor community. Tandi and the other seniors piled into a set of vans. They headed to a French restaurant in the heart of Cape Town, the setting for prom. The evening was more or less what you'd expect. A nice dinner, prawns and lamb shanks. There were toasts.
People, all look beautiful, enjoy the rest of the evening.
And there was plenty of dancing. At one point, the students and teachers all did the electric slide to an African pop song. At the end of the night, I caught up with Tandi at her dinner table. She had a huge smile. I asked how her night had gone.
It was wonderful, great, fantastic, epic, awesome. I guess you get the picture.
She said she felt like a grown-up, and it became clear why she had invested so much money and emotion in this one night. Dancing with her teachers, eating fancy food, and looking glamorous, she said this was what she wanted her future to be.
Finally, I am an adult, and I guess I've seen the woman I'm going to be when I'm older, and it's beautiful, I must say.
She took one last look at herself in the mirror. Then, along with her classmates, she boarded a van. She headed home to her leaky, tin-roofed shack. For The World, I'm Anders Kelto in Cape Town.
Again, that's a story from our year-long series set at a South African high school. Classes have now ended at COSAT. Students will soon receive final grades. Tandi and the other graduating seniors will move on. Anders Kelto will bring us a few final stories in the weeks ahead. But before the series ends, we ask Anders to tell us about the woman who keeps this inspiring school running. Here's what Anders sent us.
On a recent morning, COSAT's principal, Fadila Cooper, closed the door to her office.
So you are in serious trouble.
A nervous ninth grader stood in the corner. A science teacher, Mrs. Van Skoor, laid out a list of complaints against the girl.
Your attitude, your behavior, and your disrespect.
Mrs. Cooper, the principal, then spoke again.
And what we're going to do is we're going to call in your parents to discuss this issue with them. Because this is going to stop right now.
The girl was sent back to class. Mrs. Cooper leaned back in her chair and sighed. I asked if she and Mrs. Van Skoor were as upset as they looked.
We're just very good actresses.
But you've been coming kind.
Mrs. Cooper said she finds it hard to act tough.
I'm very, very soft with these kids. So
the reason Mrs. Cooper is soft with these kids, she says, is that she identifies with them. Like many of them, she grew up poor. As a student, she could barely afford school supplies.
I had to look, oh, where am I going to find money to buy exam pads or pencils for me to take notes? You know, it's not just, it was a struggle.
Despite those challenges, she excelled in school. But when she finished high school, she didn't think college was an option. Her parents expected her to work to support the family. But her teachers encouraged her to apply to college and helped her get a scholarship.
I suppose they saw potential in me and they saw that I would be able to succeed. I didn't believe that much in myself then.
When she graduated from college, she wanted to teach. And she wanted to encourage more students to pursue higher education the way her teachers had encouraged her. So she taught math at a local high school.
Good morning, students.
Good morning.
These days, she teaches two math classes at COSAT.
Okay. Venn diagrams.
She says she still feels at home in the classroom. Mrs. Cooper says she probably would have stayed a teacher forever, but a few years ago, she was forced to make a change. The principal left partway through the year. Mrs. Cooper says she expected one of the other, more experienced teachers to take the position. But instead, those teachers approached her. They told her she had what it takes to be a good principal, a strong work ethic and good people skills.
And then they said, well, if you don't do it, then who's going to do it? So basically, I was sort of gently coerced into the job.
Mrs. Cooper says the transition from teaching to being a principal has been harder than she expected.
It's overwhelming.
Part of the problem is that the school is stretched thin. There's no assistant principal, so Mrs. Cooper oversees all administrative work. The school can't afford a counselor, so that job falls to her. And the school has no nurse, so Mrs. Cooper often plays that role too. Earlier this year, a 12th grader named Lusanda developed a serious stomach problem. She says it was Mrs. Cooper who looked after her.
She took me to the hospital, like to my doctor. She was very worried. She even called me at night. Like she showed support and then she showed love too.
But looking after everyone else has taken a toll on Mrs. Cooper. She says the most difficult part of the job has been managing the staff. Earlier this year, she felt that some teachers weren't working hard enough. She feared that the quality of instruction at the school was falling. But she didn't know how to confront the teachers.
How do I sit a teacher down and tell her or him, listen, you are not performing. I don't have the heart to do that.
She avoided tough conversations. Her stress levels grew. Then, a few months ago, she reached a breaking point. She couldn't sleep. She had memory problems, sometimes forgetting entire conversations.
There was a stage where I actually couldn't function. And that's when I realized that I actually had to go to the doctor and talk to a doctor about these.
The doctor diagnosed her with acute stress. That episode led Mrs. Cooper to an important realization that to be a more effective principal, she needs professional training. So she applied to a program that teaches leadership and management skills. It's called the Principal's Academy. She was recently accepted. Still, under Mrs. Cooper's leadership, COSAT has excelled. It has one of the highest graduation rates of any public high school in South Africa. The teachers praise what she has accomplished. But Mrs. Cooper sees how much farther she has to go.
I need to still learn so much for me to a real proper job of being a principal.
For The World, I'm Anders Kelto, Cape Town.
Anders has produced a lot more stories from his year at a South African high school. He also has photos and videos. You can find it all at pri.org/schoolyear. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's a great time of year to give and get a book. And if you're lucky enough to have a little time off to read, even better. If you're looking for a suggestion, you're in luck. Some of my colleagues ducked into the studio earlier this week to talk about some of the books that got them turning pages this year.
All right, so the book that I chose for this year was the book that I hated in high school, the one that I just didn't get, and that is The Great Gatsby. And I finally reread it this year, and I really enjoyed it, and it turns out that you really shouldn't read this book when you're 15 years old. I'm Jennifer Gorin. I'm one of the assignment editors here at The World.
Hey, this is Clark Boyd. I'm a producer and reporter here at The World. Okay, ditching the weighty tomes and the big ideas and all that, I want to give you a great pick for science fiction this year. The name of the book is The Rook by Daniel O'Malley. It's this great story of a character who, through the course of the book, wakes up to the fact that she's in charge of this organization in Britain which protects the British Isles from supernatural forces and supernatural creatures.
This is Matthew Bell, a reporter here at The World. And I'm going to recommend a book that is co-edited by one of my colleagues at PRI, and that's Anjali Shaw. The book is called Chinese Characters, and it's a collection of profile stories about really interesting people in China today. I pored through this book on the plane on a recent reporting trip to China. It's a fantastic book. Pick it up, read it.
My name is Joyce Hackle. I'm a producer here at The World, and I chose the book A Constellation of Vital Phenomena by Anthony Mara. The book takes place during the war in Chechnya. It's about these huge questions of war and peace and how do people act during war, yet told through the voices of these very regular, powerless, flawed people. I mean, I think the character who grabbed me most was this burnt out but very dedicated physician who had nothing in this field hospital she was working in. So she stitched the people's wounds with dental floss. Who wants to sit down and read a long book about Chechnya? Especially after you hear the headlines day after day. But this book, it just made it all real. It was told through voices of people you really cared about.
My name is Bradley Campbell. I'm a producer here at The World. Men, Spain, Bulls, Bravery. A Dangerous Summer by Ernest Hemingway. Read it.
Hi, my name is Aaron Schachter. I'm an editor and host here at The World. And the book I picked this year is called Mañana Means Heaven by Tim Z. Hernandez. And okay, I got to admit, I had to read the book to interview the author, but I don't always love the books that I read when I have to interview the author. This is a great story, though, about a few weeks in the life of the Mexican girl. She's featured in Jack Kerouac's famed novel, On the Road. She's called Terry in the novel. Her real name is Bea Franco. She was a real person. Tim Z. Hernandez tracked her down and ended up writing a book from the perspective of Bea Franco.
Book picks there from my fellow World staffers. My own choice this year also happened to be a book I read to prepare for an interview with the author, Edwige Dantica from Haiti and her novel, Claire of the Sea Light. You got to read it aloud to yourself or a friend. It's like a fable set in modern times. Again, all our choices are at PRI.org. Now, remember being a nervous kid singing at your Christmas concert in your school auditorium? Okay, now imagine your auditorium is St. Peter's Basilica and your audience is the entire world. In Rome, some 30 children prepared for that this year. Angelica Marin has a story.
Sol, do, mi.
A group of 9-year-old boys from a Catholic school in Rome in one of their daily lessons. Here, reading music is as vital as math and grammar. The teaching is strict. Theory and vocal technique before lunch, then rehearsal. The goal is to sound like this. Here at Scola Puerorum, Latin for boys' school, Vatican teachers attempt to transform 9, 10, and 11-year-old boys into professional singers. They're plucked from parishes and schools around Rome to sing in the Sistine Chapel Choir, the Pope's Choir.
Scendi Giacomo, scendi giù.
It's up to music teacher Adriano Caroletti to make sure the third graders have what it takes.
Non è semplice a un bambino di 8 anni parlare di respirazione, di diaframma.
It's not so easy to talk to an 8-year-old about breathing from the diaphragm and vocal posture. You need to know how to approach them, make it a game for them. Only then you can explain to them that they must become mini professionals. It's really not easy.
Caroletti would know. He too was once a student at the school.
Comunque da bambino affronti questo clima, questa.
As a kid, you're confronted with this climate, this musical experience that stays with you for your entire life.
The choir's been around since the Middle Ages. Back then, women were banned from all aspects of the ministry, so preteen boys complemented baritones and tenors. Today, the Vatican still argues, their unique high-pitched timbre cannot be produced by girls. The choir performs all year long and at special ceremonies. The boys sang at Pope Francis' inaugural Mass last March, and soon they will be with the Pope again for Christmas in St. Peter's Basilica.
My name is Beniamino. It's the first time I sing in Christmas with the Pope, and it's big emotion.
It's also a big responsibility. Imagine being told that you're the Pope's special little helper, so the last thing you want to do is let down Pope Francis. For 9-year-old Francesco, it's a real job.
Noi facendo questo mestiere,
he says that if the boys make a mistake, it's as if the Pope messed up. If they sing flat, it's like they're embarrassing him personally. It's possible the kids might have gotten that idea from the Sistine Chapel choir director, Monsignor Massimo Palombella, a priest and composer. Palombella is intensely focused and a bit on edge, but very effective.
La più grande sorpresa che si ha con I ragazzi.
What's most surprising about the children is that if you create the right educational climate, they are capable of the highest professionalism. I would dare say a level of professionalism that goes beyond adult singers in terms of commitment, motivation, and preciseness.
But not without more practice. So Palombella invites me to leave. He then turns to his singers, raises his hands, and rehearsal begins again. For the world, this is Angelica Marin, Rome.
And that's all from us today. Here's wishing all of you a very Merry Christmas. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org, the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public Radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.